Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
This place is special.
Get asked all the time, where's your favorite place to take College Game Day? And I say every time, Eugene, Oregon.
Yeah.
This is the best crowd. Honestly, it's 6 in the morning here.
Yeah.
It's dark. Yeah. It's raining. They don't care. These fans right here, pound for pound, are as good as any college football fans in the country.
This program is staged to compete and to win championships.
Oregon is going to be in the championship game. Can you believe the magical season this has become?
When we watch this film, does our effort beat theirs?
Here's Bo Nix. Guns it! Touchdown, Oregon!
Been making deposits. Time to cash a check.
Sound at Austin, which is deafening for an Oregon 15-point win. Chip Kelly still does not have a win against his former school. We say farewell.
Man, it feels great to be a Duck.
Welcome to the QB11 Show, presented by Scoop Duck, with Doug, Andrew, and J-Hop. Here are the guys with the latest scoop.
Your ears do not deceive you, listeners. We are back. The QB11 show is still here. We live on. It's definitely been a pretty slow couple months for us recording wise. And you know, there's a lot of reasons behind that. Doesn't matter. At the end of the day, we're back. QB11, how are you? Andrew, you're back with me. And I'm Doug Scott, and we're here and we're ready to go.
Yeah, no, it's good to be back. I think, when you record, I know that we haven't always been the most consistent. Like, I think we do a pretty good job of at least getting one episode out a week. But during the season, we were doing two, sometimes three or four episodes a week. And I think that when you talk about a topic that often, it becomes like a job almost. And so I think this little bit of a recharge was good for both of us. I know we both had personal stuff going on and work. And this time of year is also just a little slower on the news. So we took advantage of that. We had a couple week hiatus, but we're back. I think we're going to be back on a regular at least once a week schedule through spring ball, and then maybe even two times depending on what we have going. But I know we have some exciting content planned for the next couple weeks and months as we lead up to the 2024 season. So I'm glad to be back. I have my football batteries recharged. I've been actually like kind of excited to talk ball and to read the boards and to listen to other college football podcasts and stuff again here recently, whereas I was going through a little bit of a lull there in February.
Yeah, there was definitely, there was times when we were talking even on the podcast that I'd be referring to like, oh yeah, and we talked about that a couple episodes ago, and I'm like, okay, why are we doing that? But there is a lot to talk about. Let's start with outgoing Ducks, soon to be former Ducks that are moving on to the next level. That the NFL Combine happened a week or so ago. I think there was five or six Ducks in attendance there. Obviously, the Oregon Pro Day will be coming up here next month as well, where not only the guys that were invited to the NFL Combine, but a lot of the ones that weren't will get to show their stuff in front of NFL scouts as well. But let's talk about the Combine. I know a lot of people are big Combine watchers. I know you caught parts of it at least, but maybe start there. Let's start with Bo Nix. Obviously, of the quarterback, I think there was five quarterbacks at the Combine, maybe six.
No, there was two groups. So he was in group one.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was in group one. So he threw with Joe Milton, Sam Hartman, Devin Leary from Kentucky, and I feel like there was one more guy in there.
That's Penix was in that group too, I think.
No, Penix was in the next group.
Okay.
But yeah, anyways, so yeah, he did his combine workout. He didn't run or jump or do any of the testing. He just threw and did interviews, and it's becoming more and more common. I'm glad that he threw, though. I think that it's good for these quarterbacks to throw. it's the thing that I think a lot of people forget. It's like, well, he doesn't gain anything by throwing because if he has a bad day, well, it's like everybody who's watching the combine, scouts included, especially scouts and GMs and coaches, understand that it's the first time throwing to the receivers. Guys run different routes, different ways. Timing isn't going to be perfect. You're not throwing for the perfect looking completion. You're throwing to show off your footwork, mechanics, and the way that you can touch the ball and different, some of the other aspects of the drill work. So I thought he performed really well in the drill work. I thought he did a good job. I mean, threw his deep ball a little flat on two of his reps, but otherwise it's really tough to critique his day throwing the ball because he has a really good stroke. He's got good foundational footwork and mechanics, and he's accurate, and that showed through the drills. And I think that he proved that he has more than enough arm. I know that DJ, Daniel Jeremiah, who's on the NFL Network cast, was talking about that. Like, a lot of people assume that Nick lacks arm, but like when you watch him throw, it's a live ball off his hands. And I thought overall it was a good performance for Bo. And I think that he reinforced everything that you would have thought about him if you were a scout watching the film. And I think that's where a lot of people get it wrong. I tweeted this a couple during the combine. A lot of people think that money is made during the combine. I actually very, very much disagree with that. Money's made on tape. The combine is just to confirm or create a second data point to make sure that the guys are athletically what you think they are on film. So people talk about, well, but I saw one guy tweeting that Bucky Irving had a bad combine. Like, no, Bucky Irving actually tested about as well as you could have hoped if you actually watched Bucky Irving's film. I don't know who was expecting Bucky Irving to go out there and run a 4.41, but that's not his game. That's never been his game. And like, people get all excited about the analytics scores based on your testing numbers, height and weight. It's like, but did people think that Bucky Irving was going to grow 2 inches and gain 30 pounds between the Fiesta Bowl and the combine? Because that's not who he is. He's not one of the most physically freaky looking guys. He's not a big imposing threat, but when you watch him in the drill work, he looked like probably the best running back in the pass catching drills. He looked extremely quick. He had good feet in the bag drills and some of the other things that they had him doing. And I thought he had a fantastic combine. A 4.56 for Bucky's a good time. And so it's all relative.
40 time for running backs has always been extremely overrated to me.
With all of this, though, like, that time doesn't change his draft stock at all. And I saw a lot of people overreacting, like, because again, it's you're comparing these triangle numbers guy to guy, and it's like, no, that's not how this works. Again, like, this is relative to film. All of these scouts have fully developed opinions about every single prospect in attendance before they run a single time. So it's not like they're waiting till the combine to see a guy run and then they go watch the film. Like, no, they know what these guys are as players. They're looking for confirmation. Like Kyrie Jackson to me running a 4.50 was actually a little slower than I expected, but it also is probably in line with what he did on film. I think my expectations were a little bit higher because of some of the GPS testing data I had saw last summer. Another guy who ran like Evan Williams running a 4.61, that's not losing Evan Williams money. Evan Williams was always going to be a late day three or undrafted free agent. And so him running a 4.61 tells me he's about exactly as fast as I thought he was. And that's going to be true for all of these scouts, GMs, and coaches as well. And so it's only a problem when a guy tests way outside of expectation. So if Troy Franklin would have showed up and ran a 4.6, he would have lost a lot of money. But he didn't. He showed up and he ran what you would expect in the low 4.4s, high 4.3s. He ran a 4.41, which, in my opinion, is a really good time for Troy. So I thought it was a good showing for Ducks. Jackson Powers Johnson had still a little bit of a tweaked, I think, hammy from the Senior Bowl, so he didn't do a lot of the testing. But you're also, when you watch the combine, are missing out on some of the most important stuff. And I saw it reported widely that both JPJ and Bo Nix had some of the best interviews that took place behind closed doors with them in meetings with teams. So I thought most of the Oregon guys had really good combines, all things considered.
Yeah, and that follows up on, you know, the stuff coming out of the Senior Bowl. I think I saw quoted after that Bo Nix was by far the the best interview, you know, and I don't mean interview in like a media sense. I mean, like the, you know, interview for a job kind of thing that happens, like you said, in private. By far and away, was the best interview at the Senior Bowl of all the players there. And I think that, I mean, even when you hear him speak, you know, to the media, which we've talked about before, right? He's usually good. And I think obviously that's showing up behind the doors as well.
And you're also, you're evaluating football character in these interviews. This isn't like when you sit down to get a job as a barista at Starbucks and they ask, like, what's one thing that you're most proud of? Like, no, like they're putting him on the board. They're showing him clips of his games. They're putting different coverages from NFL games on the board, and they're asking him what he thinks about what, and they're putting him through his paces. And like for Bo to perform well in those situations, given that he played 6,000 college games, is not surprising at all. And when you think about who he is as a person, his football character and his football intelligence, like, of course he's going to ace those interviews. I would expect nothing less. And honestly, same for JPJ. When you think about the center position, especially at Oregon, and how much intellectually is placed on those guys, calling protections and checks with the quarterback. And of course, JPJ is going to do well in that environment because he's one of the two best centers in Oregon history. So overall, I thought that Oregon players tested well. It's good to see guys running quick from Oregon. Or running faster even than I think they probably would have a couple of years ago, when then you flip the tape on and then you watch the guys from Miami, the safeties ripping off 4.65s, when I think that both of those guys would have ran in the 4.5s 2 years ago before Feld showed up. So I think Wilson Love acquitted himself well at the combine.
Yeah, and we saw that with some former Ducks who went to the combine or pro day and ran slower than expected, but we don't have to go rehash that conversation one more time. So, you know, just kind of fast forward to the draft, you know, I think we've been talking about Oregon will probably get 6, maybe 7 players drafted. You know, let's talk a little bit about where you kind of see each of those guys slotting in. So, you know, Bo, it seems like first or second round, right?
Yeah, I think it really just depends on the team, because I've seen quarterbacks. I mean, I watched Jake Locker and Christian Ponder go back-to-back picks in the teens, and it's like, okay, well, neither one of those guys were actually like first-round talents. And so, I mean, I don't know. It really just depends. Like, does a team fall in love with Bo and take him in the first round, or do they downgrade him and take him somewhere in the second? I could see either with Bo, but I would expect that he goes day one. And then I think Jackson Powers-Johnson, he's a center, but he had good measurables. I think he was taller than I expected him to be. He was 6'3 3/8", which is a really like pretty good for a interior offensive lineman. Didn't have the longest arms in the world, but again, like, we're not looking for 34-35 inch arms on a guard or center. And also, so I saw this a lot. It's another pet peeve of mine. Really quick, sorry, not to derail the conversation. Everyone's talking about wingspan. Wingspan for offensive linemen and defensive linemen does not matter. It's about arm length. The reason that there's a differentiation between the two is if you have super broad shoulders and little T-Rex arms, it doesn't show up on your wingspan. But if you have super long arms and narrow shoulders, it could make you look like you're not as long. So arm length matters. It's like, think of it like jousting. I know I've made this analogy before on the podcast. If you've got a longer joust than the guy on the other horse, you can hit him before he can touch you. And so when you see guys like Amarius Mims with 36 1/4 inch arms, like, it's like, holy freaking, that guy's got multiple inches of reach on pretty much everybody on the planet. And so like when we talk about arm length, that the reason that we're talking about and accentuating arm length over wingspan is because it's the true tell of reach, versus if I'm counting how wide your shoulders are, why do I know the relativity of your arm length? I don't. So.
The image that comes to my mind when you tell that story, which is great, is, you know, like the little kid who's like swinging haymaker punches left and right, and the dad or older brother or something kind of has their arm out on the kid's head.
Yeah.
And the kid can't reach. His punches don't land because his arms aren't long enough.
You saw it occasionally with some of our interior defensive linemen, like Taki. Like, I love the guy. He played good snaps for us. But when you don't have good length, longer interior offensive linemen, think back to the Pac-12 title game where Kaleppo and Beulah, who are really long players in the interior, were able to basically wall him off. And like, it doesn't really matter how good your hand fighting skills are. If you can't get hands on guys' chest and gain leverage, you're kind of screwed.
right? And so that's why length is important on both the defensive line and offensive line. And then the further out from the center you get, the more important length becomes. So I thought that JPJ had good testing or good measurables in terms of size. That is only going to help him because I think he's able to play guard or center. I ultimately think he gets drafted at guard, but he's got utility, right? So if he gets drafted by a team with a good center, they can put him at guard, and I think he's still worth the pick. So I could see JPJ sneaking into the late first round, but I think it's more than likely that he's going to go day two in the second round sometime.
So that probably takes us to Troy next.
Yeah, I think Troy would be your next highest rated prospect, and I think he'll be a day two pick, second or third round.
And then Brandon Dorlus?
I think he's most likely, because I think he's kind of a tweener in the NFL eyes, because he doesn't have the ideal length or twitch of somebody who's going to play on the edge, but he also doesn't have the ideal size and anchor of someone that's going to play inside. He'll get drafted for certain, but I just don't think he has, like, you're not going to use premium draft capital on a player like that. So I think he probably falls to early day three, like rounds four,
fourth
five.
Round kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Four, okay. Or five, somewhere in there.
And then, Bucky.
I think Bucky's probably early day three, again, rounds four, five. But I could see a team falling in love with Bucky and taking him late third, potentially. It's just tough because running back value is so, like, non-existent. So with a prospect like Trey Benson, who's big and runs a 4.39 and can do all of these different things, I think that there's going to be more assigned draft value to that. Whereas I think Bucky's a really good player, and I think that ultimately he'll make a 52-man wherever he ends up, and he'll be productive pro for at least a couple of years. Bucky Irving is the last kid I'm going to bet against. But I still think he probably ends up going early day three, probably rounds four or five.
All right. Who am I missing?
Kyrie, because I think Kyrie.
Kyrie, thank you.
Kyrie could sneak into late day two, in my opinion. I thought, again, if he would have ran just a little bit better, 4.5 is not a bad time for a 6.3¾ corner. And I thought his film was really good this year, but I know just because some of the stuff that my dad does with Senior Bowl, that the Senior Bowl's opinion of him was that he made up a lot of ground this year, right? Because this was his first year as a primary player, but there's still a lot of rawness to him. Like, there's still a lot of room for technical refinement. But he does have some pretty rare traits. Like, there's not a lot of 6.3¾ corners with good length, who can move like smaller athletes. And being able to run a 4.5, I don't think is a problem for him. I think he'll be able to run with guys. So it really, that one could come down to team fit and like preference, but I could see him sneaking in late day two. But I think, again, more than likely probably rounds 4 or 5 for Kyrie. But he's one of those guys where it would not surprise me if one team likes him enough that they don't want to risk not getting an opportunity at him day three.
And then that probably is what Evan Williams, kind of a bubble guy, you think?
Yeah, I think Evan Williams is probably your guy where it's like there's a chance that he goes. So here's the thing. A lot of people think that there's a big difference between an undrafted free agent or a 6th and 7th round pick. And the truth is that there's not. 6th and 7th round picks are not particularly valuable capital. And so really what you're doing is you have a board of players that are guys that you're going to try to sign after the draft. And there's guys that you don't want to risk not wanting to come to you. Those are the guys that you draft in the 6th and 7th round. And so with Evan, I know the coaches are going to love him. I mean, he's a second generation NFL guy. His dad's a ball player. He's a smart kid. I thought he's physical. I think someone's going to fall in love with him very similarly to how some people, Titans fell in love with Brady Brees. Like, I don't know that there's another team in the NFL that would have drafted Brees. But I think somebody will like Williams enough to take him late just to guarantee that they can get him.
Right. Right. Makes sense.
But it also wouldn't surprise me if he ends up just being an undrafted free agent. But he'll have plenty of camp invites and options if he is an undrafted free agent.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy? Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, I mean that totally makes sense.
I think the guys like Popo and Taimani and those guys will all get shots, but it'll be in that undrafted free agent realm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we went from a five, six year period there where, you know, Oregon was getting maybe a couple of players drafted every year. Maybe they'd have one kind of bubble year where they'd get up to six or seven. And I mean, I think it was six last year. It's probably going to be a five or six this year.
I mean, next I think year, for sure six this year, probably seven.
Six or seven, yeah. So you're talking, you know, 12 over a two-year cycle. Next year is probably going to be even higher.
Yeah, I think next year could be a lot, like, pretty significantly higher.
You're talking now a three-year, you know, after, again, you're talking two NFL drafts now, right? But the way everything's trending, you're talking about a three-year average that's going to be, you know, seven and a half, eight players a year. I mean, that just shows you, I think, kind of what we've been talking about in the roster construction, roster building, and also development that's happening in this program under this staff.
Well, I just want to run you through because I have it pulled up. So 2016, we had two guys drafted, Buckner and Walker. 2018, we had two guys drafted, Freeman and Crosby. 2019, we had four, Amadi, Hollins, Mitchell, and Jelks. 2020, we had four, Herbert, Dye, Lemieux, and Hansen. 21, we had five, Sewell, Holland, Lenore, Breeze, and Graham. 22, we only had one, we had Kayvon. And then 23, we had six with Gonzalez, DJ Johnson, Noah Sewell, Sala, Jordan Riley, and Alex Forsythe. And the reason I bring up Jordan Riley, the reason that he got drafted, and I don't think that guy's like Popo, are going to get drafted is because Riley has better length than those guys do by a pretty considerable margin. And length matters in the NFL because while there's some guys who get away with playing undersized in the NFL, those guys are freaks, right? Like those guys are like, if you're a good enough football player to not have ideal measurables and be a good interior offensive lineman in the league, then you're a dog. And, I don't know that there's special enough traits on either of Popo or Taimani to justify a late round pick, whereas Riley was big enough and had enough anchor and it was long enough to justify the pick.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. But I think the point we're making is that's a pretty significant bump in the trend, right? I mean, you're taking like a 7 or 8 year average that was probably in the two per year average. And now you're talking about, you know, the next, you know, between starting with 2023 and moving on, the average is going to be somewhere in the 7 to 8 range per year. And
well, I think that just shows. Last year was six, was a tie for the highest in program history. If we have seven this year, it'll be the highest, and I would almost guarantee that we break that next year.
Oh, yeah, I would think so, too. So, all right, anything more on the combine or draft?
No, I think that it's a good crop of players, but it's pretty crazy when you think about how this Oregon team has been projected going into next year. Lose six draft picks. I mean, you might have two guys go in the first round with another guy going day two, maybe two guys going day two. And you're projected to be a top four team. I think that's the lowest I've seen Oregon projected next year. So
yeah, anywhere from two to four seems to be the where we've seen it. Yeah.
And then you put that in line with what Justin reported today in the Juice in regards to like how Oregon is approaching talent acquisition in this class and being even more picky than they've been the last 2 years. I think it tells you like this roster is something else. I'm really excited. I was talking to somebody who I know has been around the team a little bit here recently, who said that like you walk into the HDC and it's just different. Like the quality of athlete top to bottom in the room is something that's never been seen in Oregon. So I'm really excited.
Yeah, I think we're all excited about seeing this team this year and going forward as well. All right, let's shift gears a little bit. There's some rule changes that I think will pass. I don't think they've officially passed. I think they've been recommendation and the full vote's upcoming, but it sounds like they'll probably sail through no problem. The first one, of course, headsets. Headsets for offense and defense. It sounds like they're going to finally enable that. Obviously, the Connor Stallions Michigan scandal was probably a driving factor in that finally getting pushed through. I know they've done some testing on them in the bowl games. I know a lot of teams are practicing with them in spring ball just to kind of get a feel for it. But really, you'll have a guy on defense and the quarterback on offense. You'll have a headset. It'll cut off with 15 seconds on the play clock. You know, how do you see this playing out, or do you see any pros, cons, whatnot?
I think it's great. I mean, I think it's awesome. I mean, I still think that you're going to see a lot of teams do check with me, look to the sideline, yep, and use hand signals, because it's not like these technologies are without issues, right? Like sometimes they go down, sometimes they don't work. Sometimes it was kind of funny. Danny Cannell on the Cover 3 podcast was talking about how they had a Mexican polka station that was playing music that would sometimes come through the headset when he was playing at Florida State. And so, or not Florida State, but he's playing in the NFL. And so it's like, you gotta recognize that. And so it's an advantage, like if you're worried about sign stealing, but I think it's a good thing for the game overall. And I think that it's something that there's no reason it shouldn't have happened a long time ago. You haven't gotten to it yet, but the one that I hate is the 2-minute warning. So
yeah, let's get to that in a second. One at a time. Back on the headset. I agree with you. I think that because of the 15-second cutoff, and for other reasons, and the check with me that most teams do, I still think you're going to have the guys on the sideline. So if people are thinking like the sheets and the colored t-shirts and the hats and all that stuff is going to go away, I don't think it will. Right. And if you need to, if you think about it, if you're doing check with me, what's going to make more sense? You talk into the quarterback's headset and then he's got a signal to everybody else who's already lined up, or do you just signal it from the sideline like you always have? Especially if you're getting down in the play clock when the headset goes off, right? So, but I do think it's a good change. It's needed. It gives teams, you know, another opportunity to do things in a different way. And if there's a team that's really concerned that their opponent is a notorious sign stealers and they want to keep it, keep that tamper down, now they have a tool that they can do that. So I don't see it as a negative or a positive. I kind of along the same lines. I see it only as a positive, I should say. Along the same lines, they're allowing tablets on the sidelines. I honestly didn't know they didn't allow that already. Like, I don't know why that was a rule. Like, what was that?
Whiteboards.
Yeah. I didn't even know that wasn't allowed, but now it is.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think that'll make it, like, that'll separate. I'm really interested to see what that does, actually, because I think, like, high-end quarterback play will be even more noticeable. Like,
you're not going to be looking at the black and white photos anymore that got like printed out in between drives.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, it just makes sense. Like, let's modernize the game. I don't know that it actually makes a difference, but there's no way to like measure that.
I think it obviously it's going to benefit teams who have resources and budget, you know, but at the end of the day, I think that's the way all of college football is heading towards striations of teams who have budget and resources and those that don't. So, I mean, that's just the way it goes. And I think that it's also going to, I think it's going to separate coaching, right? Like the coaches that are able to use these tools at their disposal in game to make adjustments on the fly more rapidly. That's an advantage. Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I just think that there's no reason to like keep this technology from the game.
I know. This is a symptom of the fact that the rulemaking was being done by the, you know, 330 Division I schools and 135 FBS schools, right? Because, you know, whatever the poorest or least resourced FBS G5 school is afraid because they can't afford the headsets and they can't afford the tablets. And so now nobody can have them, right? And I think we're finally out of that era, and thankfully we are, right? Let major college football be major college football. And if those programs can't or don't want to keep up, then, you know, drop down to FCS or separate G5 into its own league. Whatever the answer is, I don't care. But like, let major college football actually use the resources that they all want to use and have available to them. All right, we're going to disagree on 2-minute warning. So let's talk about that one. So the plan is to have a 2-minute warning, which is kind of will coincide with the time when they switch the clock rules from running clock after first downs to non-running clock after first downs and other things. I don't see a problem with it. I actually think it there's some amount of benefit to it. I think it's kind of a, you know, a good kind of stoppage in play to where you're kind of like, okay, now we're in crunch time here in each half. Let's reset the clock rules, make sure everyone understands we're now in new clock mode, 2-minute clock mode. And I don't really see the downside. Why are you against it?
Because you know why the 2-minute warning was even put in the NFL?
Commercials?
No. It's because they didn't have play clocks at all times. So like early on, there wasn't a play clock at every stadium.
Okay.
So that's where it came from. And so now it's like in college, it's just for commercials. There's really no reason for it.
But you know, they're not adding a commercial, right? They're actually, this will replace one of the existing commercials.
I mean, maybe.
No, the way this Joel Klatt did a great job of explaining this on his podcast. So the way it works is that in every quarter, the TV network is allowed 4 commercial breaks per quarter. And they signal down to the field when they want to use it or not. That's why sometimes the timeout is 30 seconds and sometimes it goes to commercial. Sometimes they take their break after the kickoff, whatever. So they're not getting – this now counts as one of the 4 in the second quarter and the fourth quarter. It's not an additional timeout. It's you can use this as one of your 4 just instead of one of the other times you would have used it. So it's not an additional TV break.
All right, well, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. We'll see. I guess like since there is 2 different clock rules, maybe that makes sense like logically, but I think it's unnecessary, but
it does feel unnecessary to me. I could have taken or leave this one. Like I don't really see how it's adding much or taking much away at all. I don't, you know, this feels like it kind of felt unnecessary, like some of the things that were put out last year felt unnecessary and were proven out to be somewhat unnecessary as well. So I think we'll kind of agree on that one, I guess, more than I thought. Do we want to talk about the ever-changing college football playoff landscape?
I'm sure you do. I don't really care.
Okay, well, let's set the table for our listeners. We haven't talked about this in a while, and things have happened over the last couple of weeks or couple of months. So first off, when the 12-team format was originally introduced, there was going to be 6 automatic bids, presumably, not by name, but 6 highest-rated conference champions, which would presumably be the Power 5 conferences plus 1 Group of 5 conference. Then, of course, the Pac-12 imploded, became the Pac-2. Pac-2 is not eligible for an auto bid. And so there's been a lot of push to reduce the number of auto bids from 6 to 5. Famously, the way the current playoff structure is set up, and we'll come back to this in a little bit, the way the current playoff structure is set up is that any changes to the format, to the payouts, to anything having to do with the structure of the college football playoff requires unanimous consent of all 10 conferences as well as Notre Dame. So all 11 have to agree 11-0. And famously, when everyone else was ready to move from 6-6 to 5-7, the Pac-2 representative, which was at Washington State's president at the time, delayed that vote, pushed back on it, and ultimately capitulated a couple weeks back. And so everyone voted unanimously to move the playoff format from 6 automatic bursts to 5 automatic bursts. So starting this coming season, we will have 5 conference champions and 7 at-large bids. So that's good. That had to happen. It would have been absurd for there to be 2 Group of 5 champions in this playoff, the way that the power in college football is right now. And I assume you would agree with that.
Yeah, I would agree. It makes sense.
Okay, so let's fast forward. Now they're talking about, so for 2024 and 2025, everything is set. It's a 12-team playoff, it's 5 automatic bids, 7 at-large bids. The payout distributions are pretty well set, as well as they have been for the last 10 years. Basically, every Power 5 school, and including Washington State, Oregon State will get an equal share of revenue. Every group of five school gets a much lower but also equal share of revenue, and Notre Dame gets a number that's not quite as much as Power Five schools, but significantly more than group of five schools. And all of that's locked in for the next two seasons. Now, what's been going on is that beyond the next two seasons, literally nothing exists. No contract exists. No framework exists. No agreement on payout exists. No television deal exists. No bowl deals exist. Nothing exists. So everything's wide open. And what this means is that you no longer need unanimous agreement, because there's nothing to change. It's actually, let's decide how we're going to set up this new deal. And so I think there was originally thinking that, you know, as long as you got three of the four power conferences to agree on everything, then everyone else would have to, would kind of be forced to come along, or they're left out, right? Like, okay, great. Big 12, you don't like what we're doing? Well, then don't join and we'll do it without you, and no one's going to care that you're not in it. Or certainly that thought for the group of five schools and conferences. Personally, I'm more of the belief that as long as the Big Ten and the SEC agree, like, everyone else is going to have to go along, because no one's going to care, right? If the Big Ten and the SEC form something and no one else joins it, it's still going to be the thing that gets all the money, the thing that gets all the eyeballs, and the champion that comes out of it will be recognized by virtually everyone as the legitimate champion. So that seems to be where the power is now, and they know it, and they're actually utilizing it. So there's been a lot of talk about a 14-team playoff. Big Ten and the SEC want to get the guaranteed bye and for each of them in the first round. They want to get more auto bids than the other conferences. We'll see how all that shakes out. There's a lot of negotiating going on there. The more interesting piece, which is talked about here over the last couple of days, is the revenue sharing piece. And the proposal that is, I'm going to say, I don't know if it's a proposal, but the current like line of thought there is that the Big Ten and the SEC are going to combine to receive about 60% of the revenue. The Big 12 and the ACC are going to combine to get about 30% of the revenue. And then the group of five and Notre Dame will get the other 10%. Presumably, they're not mentioned anywhere in any of these conversations, but presumably the Pac-2 schools would get whatever the group of five gets. I mean, there's no special carve out for them for both access and finance. Like they're not being, I know there was a lot of talk and hope and wishful thinking by some of the Pac-2 fans that Kirk Schultz had negotiated some sort of, you know, inclusion in the future playoff in 2026. No, he didn't. Nobody was going to give him that, and they're not going to get that. They're going to get group of five treatment. And
yeah, they are
group of probably five. What they deserve.
The most interesting thing I've heard in terms of like conversations about this is in a 14-team model is if there's a, not just the like Big Ten or SEC championship game, but a third place game to earn the third spot in an auto bid situation.
Yeah,
which I think would be awesome. I think like talk about, first of all, you already know the conferences want it because it's going to be big money from TV revenue. But I think that would be really fun. Like, let's say it was Penn State versus Michigan for a bid to the playoff, and then the first place game is for a bye week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And imagine if you set that up as a doubleheader, right? So you have your Big Ten doubleheader, you know, in Indy or where I think they're going to start rotating those games around. Like, that would be incredible, right? And I think
you could have one in Indy and one in Vegas in the same day.
Yeah. Yeah. There you can do it that way. Yeah.
And you could rotate which city hosts. I mean, I'm just thinking idea wise. Like, and like that would make, I think that would make the conference title games even more fun to watch, but also it would make that third bid. Like if you finish fourth, unfortunate for you, like you're not, I mean, I guess you could try to get you're not getting an auto bid on a certain year. You might still get the at large, but.
Well, what was interesting to me when you started hearing all this conversation about the auto bids go around is pretty much universally all the podcast people just hate it. They absolutely hate it. I've taken a different thought around it. Is what this shows to me is that there is concern, and I think legitimate concern, in the SEC and the Big Ten about the selection committee and about how the selection committee is going to treat schools with different records, but also very different strengths of schedules, right? And this is one thing we're going to see play out this year potentially, and next year in the 12-team model is, if you've got a 9-3 SEC school who played five top 10 programs, or a Big Ten team who played five top 10 programs, and then you've got a 10-2 Big 12 team who played no top 10 programs, well, you know, the way the polls have traditionally worked, even the way the selection committee has traditionally worked, they're so skewed towards record and counting losses, right? And I think that the SEC and the Big Ten are concerned about that. And I think they should be concerned about that. And I think that's part of the reason why they're thinking about this, like, let's have more auto bids per conference, right? Because, yeah, you look at it and go, yeah, most years the SEC and the Big Ten will get at least three teams each. Why do they need to go say they need to be auto bids? Well, I think this is why, because the brutal schedules that some of these teams are going to have, I think they're worried about their teams, which are much better, are going to get passed over by teams in some of these other leagues who played really weak schedules, especially those other leagues. Like a league like the ACC is even a better example than the Big 12, because at least the Big 12 has a lot of competition up and down. ACC is such a top-heavy league now. You got a team like, oh, I didn't play Florida State and I didn't play Clemson and I rolled through the rest of my schedule. Okay, well, how good is that team? Are they better than a team that maybe has one more loss but had to play Ohio State, Oregon, Michigan, and USC all in the same year? You know, I mean, it's a fair question and it's a fair concern. And that's why I kind of like the auto bids. Also, it becomes more objective. It recognizes the fact that there are much better teams in these two conferences than the others. And that's just a fact. And I also think it then puts control, like you said, into the hands of the conferences to decide who are our three representatives, right? And we want to have this extra game at the end of the year to between three and four, a play-in game. Awesome.
Yeah. I don't disagree.
No argument for me. I mean, I like the direction that this is going, to be honest with you. So,
I do too. I think a lot of people say, "Oh, well, why don't they just go to 16?" I actually don't think I don't think they want to go to 16. I think the Big Ten and the SEC, I think that, and when they threw out the proposal of guaranteeing themselves the top two seeds and the only two byes, I think a lot of that is about preserving the value of their title game.
Yeah, right. I agree.
I mean, and if they go to 16 teams, they don't have a bye. Now that title game has almost no value anymore, right? And that game is incredibly valuable to them and their TV partners. So I think if it does go to 14, I think it's going to stick there for a while.
Yeah, I do. I agree. And I also think that from a numbers standpoint, if they're trying to keep equity with the ACC and the Big 12, and now this might get reshuffled when the ACC collapses and the Big 12 gets the, like, or however that consolidation takes place, right? If it goes to three leagues, would the Big 12, I wonder how they would split up those, like, would they just give one of, I'm trying to think here. So the way it sets up right now in a potential 14, you would have two Big 12 bids, right?
Yeah, it's 3-3, 2-2, one group of so five.
In this case, would they go to, if it was at 14 and the eight, let's say Clemson and Florida State and all those teams bounce and then everybody else goes to the Big 12, or maybe there is still a second league. I don't know how that would function.
Yeah.
But would they just, how would they divvy up those extra two bids?
I think the two important things about the governance of the CFP that's being discussed in this new model going forward is, one, is there's no longer going to be unanimous consent requirement to make changes. They haven't worked out exactly what the voting rights are, but you know, I think the SEC and the Big Ten are both pushing for a larger share of the, right? Instead of having, you know, 1/10 of the voice each, that their weight, they should carry more weight, right? So some sort of voting shares kind of thing. Model. I don't know. We haven't heard a lot of details about what that might look like yet, but only that it will not be unanimous. Like, it will not require unanimous consent to make it. Like, I think this whole Washington State Pac-2 thing, I think there was already going to be a move against unanimous consent, but I think that thing really hammered it home that, like, we're not going to let, you know, some group of five conference in the MAC or the Sun Belt, like, hold up how we need to progress this game because, you know, they're going to hold out their vote. Like, that's just not going to happen. So That's one major change that will be in place. The other one is the discussions that were reported on today by Ross Dellinger. Does an exceptional job reporting on this stuff, and so does The Athletic as well. But the latest stuff reported today was that there would be a look-in period in 2028, kind of an automatically triggered look-in period to make adjustments. But the other thing is that any additional conference realignment will automatically trigger a look-in as well. So that's an opportunity for them. Like if that were to happen, right? If ACC, Clemson, Miami, North Carolina, whoever leaves the ACC, whether or not the ACC ends up imploding or staying in some lesser form, there would be a look in there to say, okay, it no longer makes sense for that league to get two automatic bids. Maybe they get treated like a group of five. Maybe they get one and the other one goes to the Big 12 or the other one goes to the Big 10 or the SEC. You know, that who knows, but they have that ability.
The one thing
to
I don't see
that.
Is there ever being an equity between the Big 10 and the SEC. And so that's why I was curious is like in a world where three or four teams are two teams go to the SEC and two teams go to the Big 10. I'm just using this for to make it a simple analogy. Mm-hmm. Like, do you give a whole bid to both the SEC and the Big 10? Or do you give one bid to the Big 12, additional bid to the Big 12, and then just add in that large bid?
I guess there's no way they're going to ever give Big 12 equity, right? They're not going to give
even
Big
if the Big 12 had like
treatment.
26
doesn't
teams.
Matter. But the quality of those teams isn't even close.
No, I understand that. I guess that's,
they would probably do, my guess is what they would do because they were already pushing for four automatic bids each, right? 4-4, 2-2, 1, and then one at large. And there was enough pushback on that I think they've kind of acquiesced down to three automatic bids each. But if the ACC went away, I think they would just say, okay, well, we'll have four each. The Big 12 can still have their two, and then we'll just have, you know, one less at large if the ACC still gets one, let's say.
Yeah,
that's what I would guess. I think they would. The Big 10 and the SEC will absolutely keep equity in both revenue
because
and
you have to think that the SEC and the Big access. 10 are going to eat up most of the at-large bids every year.
Well, depending again on how the committee treats those scenarios that we talking
already
about
know
earlier,
how the,
right?
We already know how they're going to treat them, though. Because we saw how hard it was for the – well, we have a pretty good idea based off how the committee treated Cincinnati. It took like a doomsday scenario for Cincinnati to get in.
I think it's more about how is the committee going to treat the fourth place Big Ten or SEC team who maybe is 9-3 versus the second or let's say the third place ACC or Big 12 team who's maybe 10-2. I think that's the real question that we don't have an answer to.
In most years, the fourth place team and like the analytics will back this up. And
I totally agree with you, QB, but it's not about what the analytics will say and what the common sense viewer will say. It's about what the committee will do and has done, and they have a lot of history of counting losses.
All right, well,
so we'll see. I think that's what the Big Ten and the SEC are want to protect against, right? By having more auto bids.
Fair enough.
All right, we've covered that. We've covered this. Anything else you want to talk about today?
No, I think that was pretty much everything. I mean, honestly, how long did we just
go? 45 minutes.
That was pretty good.
Not bad for our first episode back. We'll ease our way back into it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's plenty to talk about here over the coming weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the spring ball is going to be starting up, you know, here real quick before we know it. We'll have some stuff to talk about there. The Oregon Coaches Clinic is coming up in April as well. Spring game, obviously in April. Spring transfer portal window, that'll generate a lot of conversation. And then we start kind of getting into like, you know, recruiting getting hot and heavy as the dead period just ended again. So there'll be a lot of visits here the next couple of months. We'll have that to talk about. We'll get Justin back on as well for some of those conversations. And then, you know, commitments start in the summer. Oh, we didn't talk about the signing day move. Let's touch on that real quick in a second. And then, but also coming back around to what we have coming up is, you know, there's a lot of talk about like, you know, looking across the landscape of the Big Ten Conference and the SEC and the rest of the country and, you know, what teams are trending and what directions and maybe starting to make some predictions as we go through the spring and into the summer as well. But let's circle back on the signing day conversation. So there's been a lot of discussion about moving the middle signing day, the early signing day, and it has officially been moved. It's now a couple weeks earlier. So instead of being the third Wednesday in December, it's essentially the first Wednesday after the last regular season game. So it'll happen in between the regular season game and the conference title games. And this was done to really reduce the workload on coaching staffs in that middle of December. They're trying to lock down their class. They're trying to prepare for playoff games now. And they're trying to like work through the transfer portal. There's so much going on at that period of time. So they moved that up a couple of weeks. So now the signing day will happen before the transfer portal window opens, which is, I think, an important change. Thoughts on that one?
No, I think this is like really intelligent, and I'm glad that they finally did this. This should have happened. I know that it happened because of the 12-team playoff, but it should have happened before. It's
one other thing that.
It's completely inequitable to the teams that I've used that word way too much today. It's completely unfair to the teams that are competing for conference titles that they can't host visitors and do all these different things during that last weekend, while teams that didn't play well during the regular season can. So this evens the playing field. I think coaches will be happy about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it might accelerate some of the coaching turnover, but honestly, I think that's been pretty well accelerated already. So I don't know how much more that's going to happen as it is. But the other thing they talked about, which they've now kind of punted on a little bit, which I am a huge fan of, and I think I can't wait for it to happen. I think it will happen. But that is potentially adding an even earlier signing day in the summertime. I think they're talking about the last week in June now. They're not going to do it for this summer. There's a lot of talk about it potentially happening next summer. And it's going to be, it's kind of been put in play with some additional changes to the recruiting calendar that they're talking about making. So all of that's being set up together and it'll be voted on later in the year. But the idea that there'd be an even earlier signing day, personally, I would do this instead of the December one, but I think it sounds like that might be trending toward there being three signing days, which feels a little overkill to me. But there'll be one in late June in addition to the December and February ones. What are your thoughts on that one?
I like it, but like you just have to understand that if there's coaching staff movement, all those kids that sign in June are probably getting out of their NILs. But like, yeah, I think that would have been big coaching. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you have coaching stability, I think it'll be a good thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, in previously, I think that would have been a big deal. But now, like, NLI, like, kids get out of NLIs all the time now. It's, like, accelerated so much over the last couple of years. So I kind of feel like, yeah, that's just part of the system.
The NIL already doesn't really matter, right? So, like...
Right, you just transfer anyway.
Yeah, you exactly. So this just makes it easier.
It's just paperwork.
Kids, like, want to can get it done. And then they can get announced by the school or whatever, and... I think it's cool. So,
yeah, I'll be interested to see is what we saw happen with the early signing day when it started in December was it quickly became the signing day, right? And 98% of the players were signing in December period. And I would not expect that to happen with the June one, right? I'll be curious to see how that play, like how many of the, like, let's say top 300 players, right, end up signing in the June window. Is it half? Is it a quarter? Is it three quarters? Where does that end up landing? And it's an interesting dynamic too, because, you know, you have these commits and they're like, okay, you offered me, I committed, you want me, where's my paperwork, you know? And then if the school actually is kind of maybe not, you know, so keen on making them part of their class for sure, that could be an interesting dynamic as well.
Yeah, well, obviously their kid wants to sign, they don't let them.
Right. And then actually that's good for the kid. So I think this is pro player, right? Because now that kid will know where he stands in June, and he's got 6-8 months to figure out a landing spot versus now, right? That happens in December and that kid's scrambling to find a new home.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, QB. I think we've covered it for today. We will be back with you next week, and we'll talk about something. Football.
There will be plenty to talk about. Spring ball's right around the corner. We can start doing some previews. So there's lots of stuff to talk about.
Sounds good. Thank you all for listening. Again, follow him at QB11SD. You could follow me on Twitter at DouglasTS. Follow the show at QB11Show. We're excited to be back with you, and we are excited about spring football. Thanks all for listening.